And good afternoon, and welcome to Lambda Weekly, the world's longest-running LGBT radio show. I'm David Taffet, celebrating Passover in a room surrounded by Southern Baylor sissies. The late Patty Fink, writer and director Del Shores, and actor and producer Emerson Collins. You know Del from his play, film, and TV show Sordid Lives. He wrote and produced the last 2 years of Queer as Folk. If you heard Leslie Jordan on our show 2 weeks ago, chances are Del wrote most of what Leslie said. Del's latest play, Yellow, was produced last year by Uptown Players, and his play Southern Baptist Sissies is now a movie that Emerson stars in and produced. You can also watch Emerson watching TV Tuesday nights at 9 o'clock on Bravo's The People's Couch, and most important, he's a new columnist for Dallas Voice. Welcome, Del and Emerson.
Thank you so much. We're excited to be here.
Okay, so Southern Baptist Sissies screened this week at the Texas Theater down in Oak Cliff, and you packed him in.
We were really, really happy with the crowds and the response. I've still, just this morning, I was trying to answer all the messages I got. A lot of Southern Baptist sissies in this town really respond to that play.
I mean, everybody I talked to in the lobby said, ooh, this is the first time I've ever been at the Texas Theater.
The whole Lee Harvey Oswald thing, I'm fascinated by. I didn't know that when we booked it there.
Oh,
and so,
yeah.
Yes, I definitely had to take a photo of myself sitting in the seat, even though they've redone the chair, so it's not the original chair, but it's still the right
seat. It's the place.
Yes,
it's the place.
A little, I don't know, weird, creepy, macabre moment.
Right. You know, and it's funny, it's just a regular movie theater. It's just that's where they happen to arrest him, but it gives it this whole weird vibe. If it wasn't for that, that theater would be gone.
Yeah. Well, and for people who don't know.
Oh, yeah. And it's kind of sat empty for years, and it was renovated like two or three times, and it wasn't until this renovation a few years ago that the theater's taken off.
And it's had
again.
A real revival.
Yeah.
Yeah, for people who don't know and haven't been down there, I mean, it's a beautiful space, and they do a lot of really cool things. They've got a great bar in the lobby. They do, you know, sort of open mics, multi-purpose. So if you're looking for a great art scene, you should head down there. Check out their website. Yeah. They're not paying me to say that. I just love being down there.
And they treated us really, really well. And, if you're four-walling a movie, which is what we did, it was very affordable for us. I mean, we didn't walk away broke.
Well, and they did something really cool, like with the big JFK 50th anniversary we had about 6 months ago, the 50th anniversary of the assassination. The Texas Theater played the movie they played that day, which was The War, which I thought was very interesting. That's what they ran the whole day.
Oh, so that was what was playing the day that he...
In 1963.
Yeah.
I thought that was a kind of an interesting thing because there were obviously a lot of buffs in town. And
I would think.
I thought it was just very cool.
They were playing some naked movie after us.
Dan Savage's amateur porn hump film festival was screened after us last night. So it was perfect. You could see... Talking about his sissies and then see some amateur porn. So what's not to love about Dan Church for Easter weekend?
So they were serious when they told me that porn was going to be playing there.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
Well, why would somebody lie about that?
I thought it would be interesting if they would just have all of the patrons come naked and pass out like saran wrap to put on the seat, you know, to keep everything clean. I mean,
makes sense.
Marketing. I've got thoughts, lots of thoughts.
I think we should get to vote at the door on who gets naked.
So are you saying that Southern Baptist Sissy has no nudity?
It has a little nudity. Yeah, it does. Emerson's
tushy.
But I've always fought very hard, quite frankly, with other productions to make sure that the nudity was not gratuitous, because it is truly a movie about the clash of sexuality and religion. And you cannot have that movie without seeing some of that. But I didn't want it just to be like, you know, one of those crazy 80s gay plays that just, you know, people came just to... We're on FM. I can't, right?
And it's live.
Full frontal nudity.
There you go. I'm just like censoring my head, right? That just right and left. It's almost like, you know, speaking Spanish again. I'm having
take a break. Emerson will put the word in, the appropriate word in.
Thank you, Emerson.
Emerson's very appropriate.
He fills in the words many times for me. I'm also old, so I'm just like getting stumped in life.
Okay, so Southern Baptist Sissies, a number of people have seen it because you've done how many productions of it here? I know Uptown Players did it. Kitchen
Uptown
Dog did it.
We did the Kitchen Dog at the Mac. Mm-hmm. And then we came on tour here, and we had, for a while, we had the record at the Majestic for the most, I think they added some seats, so we sold out the Delta Burke, Leslie Jordan, Del Dickey.
Emerson Collins
and
tour.
Emerson Collins tour. Yeah. Now we would probably put you on the
ads. I'd be like, it would be like in really big letters, Delta Burke, Dale Dickey, Leslie Jordan, Southern Baptist Sissies, Emerson Collins, really little underneath.
With Dallas,
yes.
It's kind of fun always. I mean, we're joking about this, but it is fun to see somebody that you've worked with who really deserves it. And Emerson, I was just, the irony is I teach in this building that we're in right mm-hmm. now, and I was talking to acting coach extraordinaire Michelle Condre on the way over. I didn't even tell you. She was raving about your performance in Sissy. She said, I never knew him as anybody except that introduced your shows and produced your shows at the Rose Room. And she said, he is so amazingly brilliant. And it's wonderful to see. In my life, I've gotten to see many of these things where, you know, I worked with Leslie Jordan before anybody knew who Leslie Jordan and Dale Dickey and Octavia Spencer. And, you know, there's, the list is nice.
Mm-hmm. You work with some fabulous people, I have to say. I mean, it's like a joy to read cast lists on stuff you do. It's just great.
Well, and it's the other way around. It's that really great people want to work with him because so few people write such great roles. And also specifically and especially for brilliant women, you know, that they're often the girlfriend or the wife or that, you know, there's sort of this one-dimensional character and all of his women are these brilliant, amazing, wonderful things. And that's mm-hmm. how you get people like Dale Dickey wanting to work with him 14 times, mm-hmm. and Octavia Spencer shooting The Help and then saying she wanted to come back and shoot Blues for Willa Dean with him. And Rue McClanahan said yes to sort of the series in the first place, just off reading the script.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she said yes before she said, how much does it pay?
That's the way you like it, right?
And I said, not much, and she said, I figured. She said, I will do it.
Do you know, I interviewed Rue, and my interview was her last interview.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was just before she was here. You were here, she was here, and a couple of other people were performing with you down at the Majestic. But when she was talking about the different things that she had done, it wasn't, oh, this one made the most money for me. It was, you know, that one made a lot of money. It was a piece of, you know, garbage. But Sordid Lives was one of the things she was really proud of.
Well, she was so wonderful in it.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that she said to me, which, I tell this story in one of my shows where, I just ask for many times for what I don't guess I deserve, because I said, who is right? I wrote that role for Rue McClanahan, not thinking I would have a shot at all of getting her. And then I went on IMDb and I found her manager, and her manager was just done. Rue was her last client. That was her last living client. And she's that very crusty Barbara Lawrence. And so she had no idea who I was. Mm-hmm. But Rue had seen my play Daddy's Dying Who's Got the Will on stage, mm-hmm. and was friends with Beth Grant. So she was aware of my work, and then so she wanted to read all 12 episodes. And she read them in a day, mm-hmm. and the next day I get this call and this, you know, the they were going, Rue McClanahan's on line 3, and I'm so nervous. And she said, I never thought that I would get to play a woman in love again at my age. Mm-hmm. I love to play a woman in love. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the main things that attracted her to me.
Yeah. But she raved about her roles where she was good. Mm. And it wasn't where she made money.
I mean, she truly is. And that's one of the things that, Olivia Newton-John is my good friend, and who just sent me, while we're sitting here, Happy Easter. And again, I mean, a superstar, but I just knew her socially. Mm-hmm. But I said, hey, you want to be in Sordid Lives, you're going to get paid $800. And most of them all come from the theater. And when someone has that, I mean, like Emerson comes from the theater, and you get that opportunity in the theater. You get that opportunity to scratch deep with the roles, and that's why.
Okay, so Emerson, you're just playing one of the roles in the Uptown Players version of Southern Baptist Sissies. And I would think when anybody's in a play, you know, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, okay, yeah, it's going to be me and we're going to Broadway with this. But you went on to not only be the star of the show, which was not the role you had with Uptown, but you're also became a producer.
Yeah.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well, it's you know, it's interesting. I tell the story two ways. One, when I played Benny, the drag queen, with Uptown Players, when I got cast in that role, it was the end of, I did 18 shows in 3 years before I arrived at Sissy's. And as we are auditioning and they're trying us in the different roles, I said, you know, I really think I want to play this drag queen role. I think that's the one I want to shoot for, because it was so different from the sort of young ingenue type roles that I was sort of bored with playing. Mm-hmm. At the time, but I said, but I'm terrified. I mean, I could be awful. Unlike some homosexuals, I had never put on a pair of heels before, so there wasn't like a guarantee this was going to work. But I always say, you know, it was sort of me wanting to challenge myself and continue to grow. And when we opened the show, Del flew in to see it, because it was one of the play wasn't completely published yet, and it was one of the first productions. And being, you know, controlling and type A, he wanted to see how we did, and so he flew in and was there for our opening night. And of course, for us, that's just sort of the be-all end-all of the world, that this big playwright's here to see our production. And we had a great time, and he was very lovely, and you know, we talked that night, and I wrote him an email a while later saying, you know, thank you very much, this piece means a lot to me, and you know, I really appreciated your feedback and your response and all of that. And so he wrote me, I think, 2 months later and said, what are you doing? Why are you in Dallas? And I said, I'm saving money to move to New York or LA. And he said, well, I'm remounting a revival of this show in Los Angeles, and would you like to come be a part of that? And I, you know, breathed deeply a significant number of times and said yes, and packed all of my earthly possessions into my high school cheerleader car. That's what my brother calls it. It was one of those Saturns with the, like, half door. And so he always said, it looks like you're driving to high school cheerleading practice. And I said, well. And arrived the day before Thanksgiving to start rehearsals for the LA production. And I arrived Wednesday night before Thanksgiving that year and showed up at his house the next day for Thanksgiving. And he said, hey, you know, we're doing a little Thanksgiving thing. And I'm having a bunch of people over. You can come meet everybody. Well, great. I don't know anyone. I don't have any friends. And I show up at his house, and it's like 60 people, including Leslie Jordan and Debbie Holiday and most of the cast of Sorted Lives. And I thought, oh my gosh, I am so far
freak out.
My head. I should get back in my car and drive back home and be like, I was just kidding. I'm so sorry. I'm not supposed to be here.
And we're like, and now you're immersed in this world. But at that point, I mean, I don't think that this is impressive on any level to anybody to walk in and see Leslie Jordan in your house or Dale Dickey or whomever. But you know, these are our friends. They're the one thing that's great about the people that we work with and continue to work with is they are, I was going to say common, but that's not the right word. They're down to earth. Mm-hmm. They're mostly Southern people, and we're just very grateful.
And do you know, Leslie's been to our office, and in person, he's the exact same personality he is on stage. But
He just, as we're sitting here, uh-huh. I wrote him because I said, you cannot mm-hmm. do what you did the other day, because there was something very confidential that he almost announced. And he said, I know that was a momentary, I see, lapse in judgment. And then he goes, up from the grave he arose. With the body. What goes here? Triumph or his foes.
You didn't know that, Patty, did you?
Know these things.
You
yes.
didn't know that, Patty.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you
yeah.
did. Okay. And by the way, when you said, you know, you're the one homosexual who has never worn heels, there's another one in the studio who never has either. Patty.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That seems fair.
Yeah.
And Patty, we were probably equally awful at it. I mean,
absolutely.
Because originally the Tina Turner number that's in the film was Shania Twain, and so mm-hmm. the director here in Dallas and I went to one of those, you know, hooker stores on Harry Hines and bought me a pair of thigh-high streetwalker boots. And after rehearsal every night, I would put them on and for 30 minutes just sort of stumble back and forth trying to get to where I could walk in the heels for, you know, for the 4 minutes it was going to take to do it in the play. And I'll be honest, I never got great at it. I got to where I could get through like the 3 minutes of the number and then, oh Lord, please get off of these and get back on dry land.
Try doing that with a girdle and a bra.
No.
You know?
Well, Leslie, back to Leslie, he once did, I think it was either Black Tie or HRC, he said, Dale, you know the difference between the lesbians in Dallas and the lesbians in L.A.? When you go to these HRC dinners in L.A., they've decided just to go with the tuxes and the comfortable shoes. In Dallas, they're still trying to, some of those lesbians are still trying to walk in heels. Like hogs on ice.
so true. Oh my gosh.
I just educated him. I said, try a horse bows. So he's got it. He's got
so he has it now. Well, good.
He can go to Easter service wherever he is.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say, I know we have to take a break soon, but I remember when you posted on your Facebook page, Del, about Southern Baptist hymns that had like blood.
Yeah.
That had really gory things in them. And the list just kept coming. It's just amazing. You know, and I was raised a Southern Baptist, as I'm sure I know you were. And
yes.
Were you too,
yes.
Emerson? And, you know, that just hit home so well. But it's just chock full of that stuff.
Well, you know, my last show, the one that is about to come out, Naked Sorted Reality, that I filmed at the Rose Room, I opened that show singing There Is a Fountain Filled
with Blood
from Emmanuel's Veins. And that's now I'm imagine you're 6 years old hearing these lyrics drawn. And I said, I think a nurse wrote that song. So it's like, talk about drawing blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's scary. And when you think about a little kid, I mean, we've been there. We were little kids in the blood.
The lamb. I mean, it's like, but a fountain filled with blood.
Blood.
A fountain? That's a lot. That's a lot of blood.
Where it is.
Fountain?
Yeah. Oh, indeed.
That's what I want to know.
Isn't it in Highland Park?
There was a picture in my little 5-year-old head of a fountain filled with blood.
Mm-hmm.
And were sinners plunging?
Yes, absolutely.
All their guilty stains.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet in the studio with a whole bunch of heathens, and they're all going to hell. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
Russian rock and roll party of the year, and it's Friday, May 2nd, with Igor and the Red Elvises at the Sons of Herman Hall. Joining Igor and the Red Elvises will be the Pomegranate Vibrato Belly Dancers. A free dinner from the Alligator Cafe will be included. It's a night of unheralded rock and roll fun and dancing madness. Get your tickets now at KNON.org, Bill's Records, or Forever Young in Grand Prairie. Don't miss this, or you'll spend the rest of the year trying to make up for lost fun. Igor and the Red Elvises, the Pomegranate Vibrato Belly Dancers, and a free dinner from the Alligator Cafe. Friday, May 2nd at the Sons of Herman Hall in Dallas. Doors open at 7. Red Elvises play 2 sets. All Red Elvises all night long. For more information, KNON.org. This is a KNON benefit event.
The YW Nurse Family Partnership is a program of the YWCA that pairs registered nurses with economically challenged first-time mothers in Dallas County. Nurse visits start during pregnancy and continue until the child reaches 2 years of age. Nurses help mothers provide a safe environment for their child, offer support and referrals to other services, and help with setting and achieving goals. To see if you qualify for this free program, 214-584-2322 or ywcadallas.org.
This is Jason Wright from Dallas, and I listen to Lambda Week 89.3K.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave.
This is Kimberly Truax of the GLBT Wedding Expo, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3.
Oh, is it still playing? That's how. they're laughing at our old equipment here. We just recently got rid of our 8-track machines. So,
what's that? I'm surprised you don't have like those live singers in the.
Brought to you by
live commercials.
Hey, no, we had the latest in 8-track technology here in the studio.
The latest, the last 8-track technology.
Well, it was only 2-track by the time it died, but we had it here. We're talking to Del Shores and to Emerson Collins. They are the writer, director, producer, and star of the new film Southern Baptist Sissies. Tell us a little bit about the film. It's not done like a normal stage to screen production. Usually a writer will open the film up. It'll, you know, you might actually film it in the places where it is supposed to take place. You didn't do that with this.
Yeah, I've done that 3 times. I want to do something different.
Hmm?
No, this is my fourth film of one of my plays, and Emerson had the idea. I mean, it had a lot to do with a financial consideration mm-hmm. initially, and now we're really glad that we did it this way. But you can tell a little bit more about how we actually filmed it.
Well, after our last, you know, big budget film adaptation of his play, The Trials and Tribulations of a Trailer Trash Housewife, as Blues for Willadine, you know, we said we really want to work on our own. We're both type A and entirely too controlling to produce by committee. So we said, what's the first thing we want to do? When we both feel really strongly about Southern Baptist Sissies as a piece, it's personal for both of us, and we've talked a lot about the fact that the irony of the success the LGBT community is having with legislation and equal rights moving ever slowly forward is that the far, far right fanatics are using much harsher language and even greater vitriol than they even were, say, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's that thing that happens when people can tell they're losing and they start lashing out. Well, we all know it's awful, but there's still kids sitting in small conservative communities and conservative families and conservative churches hearing that language. So we said this is the piece that we wanted to do first for our new company. And the reality of LGBT independent filmmaking is that getting financed is difficult. You know, people want to see quick profits, and saying, well, this piece is really meaningful doesn't really work great in a fundraising meeting. So we said, what's a way we can do this really cheaply? And he's told so many stories over the years of the incredible impact this piece has in the theater, you know, with the actors speaking to the audience for so much of it. There's a very interactive element. And I said, why don't we see if we can translate that to the film-going audience, if we can just make their seats an extension of the seats in the live theater. So we said, let's shoot the play live with real audiences and get all of that reaction, and then shoot it like a film as well, so that in all of the dramatic and intimate moments, you can get really close mm-hmm. and get the intensity that's so special to film.
It's, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes into the film. Before I knew you had done that, but it's about 10, 15 minutes into the film before I even realized, yeah, the audience really is there. They weren't just performing it on stage, but they were there, because that's the first time you turn toward the audience and you see a little outline of the audience, a shadow of the audience across the bottom of the film.
That's just incredibly so, yeah. creative. Uh-huh. Kind of a slice with House of Cards where they turn and look, you
yes.
know, and talk. That's really very cool.
And, you know, I mean, it wasn't like this has been done before. Mm-hmm. Right? We had Playhouse 90, and mm-hmm. we've had there have been. I mean, there was the Long Beach Journey Into Night, I think, was filmed with Katharine Hepburn many, many years ago. But for me, I knew that a lot of those were very big master shots, or they would come in for, like, say, you know, you guys are sitting there, that two shot, but they never did extensive coverage. Mm-hmm. And so the great thing about this group of actors, I mean, the Sissies were all new to those roles. I mean, Emerson had been in the play, but not in that role. But I rehearsed it just like I rehearse a play. Mm-hmm. I mean, we literally gathered. We would gather in my house first, and then we gathered at the theater, and everybody stepped up. And you can film a lot of pages fast if actors are prepared. And I mean, even when I've done film and Sorted Lives, the series, the reason we could film 12 episodes in 36 days is because I made those actors prepare, and or I hire the actors that are willing to prepare. So it, you know, 10 days of shooting is not, it's a record for me. I mean, Blues for Willadine, we shot in 14, which was very quick. Mm-hmm. But again, the actors had done, every single actor in that movie had done the play, and so they were prepared. You can to tear up a trailer house like David Steen did, mm-hmm. and hit every mark mm-hmm. while you're doing it, you have to be prepared. Mm-hmm.
Well, and this was intense because for the live show portions, we used three cameras and shot the play all the way through with audiences four times in 2 days. So we did a matinee and an evening 2 days in a row with three cameras at all four performances mm-hmm. to get 12 different camera angles with audiences, and then 8 days with two cameras to do all the close-ups and coverage. But it also meant as actors performing it to the size necessary to communicate all the way into the theater, and then in the film shoot, choosing which scenes we could bring the performances in order to feel size appropriate for a camera 6 inches from your face. So it was sort of a schizophrenic thing that then the editing we used the editing to cross the seam between the wider shots for the comedy and the close-ups in the drama.
You told a story the other night at the theater about one scene that you loved but you didn't use, and that was when Leslie had a tear in his eye.
When I wrote this play originally, it's almost like two plays. Mm-hmm. There's the Peanut and Odette, the Oasis bar, and then there is the Oasis? Did I change it? I can't remember.
I think so.
Is it the Oasis? And then there's the church and the boys. Mm-hmm. And they never really collided in the original draft. And Leslie and I went to the dog park one day. You know, that's where we used to meet with our dogs. And he said, "Dale, I wish that I could connect with one of those boys. Mm-hmm. I just wish that." And so I went home. I said, "You're so right. That would absolutely."
Mm-hmm. Oh, it works so well.
Mm-hmm. And so I wrote. I mean, that scene is probably mm-hmm. maybe 3 minutes long, mm-hmm. if that. But it's so simple. And talk about sense memory. I can't even think about that scene without getting emotional. It is such a powerful scene. And when we premiered the play, everybody knew Leslie was hysterical. We've seen him a million times, but I really knew because when he did Brother Boy, there were just moments where he broke your heart.
Yes.
Just a sentence. And so I gave him more than one sentence here. And he won every single award available for that performance. Mm-hmm. And I always say, I don't think it was for the comedy. I think it was for that 3 minute mm-hmm. scene. It was so powerful. And yes, I always wanted Peanut to just sober up, completely sober up and do that, you know, because he's supposedly drunk and walking down this street, and then he sees that boy and he says, "Don't become me." And Leslie performed that. He just performed it to perfection. But he says, "Because of Paxil, I'm not able to cry anymore." And he did when we were doing the scene. And I think it also had to do with the amazing performance of Matthew Scott Montgomery. All you have to do is look at that boy and, you know, get emotional. And there was a tear that dropped. And I chose not to use that particular take because I didn't want Peanut to ever. I wanted the audience to cry. I wanted Andrew to cry. I did not want Peanut to cry. I wanted that strength.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you want me to tell how he got to that moment?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Well, afterwards, I mean, I just wanted to go and, you know, throw him up in the air and celebrate. I had never directed him ever.
I don't think little people like it when you do that.
They don't.
I wouldn't.
Yeah,
I'm only this tall. You know.
And if you go, "Wee," they hate that.
Yeah. So, yes, they do.
They really don't like that. I've stopped. I said, "Leslie, what did you do? And he goes, "Well, I just thought of Florence Ballard's funeral." "The Supreme?" And he goes, "You know, she died broke, Dale. They kicked her out of that group and replaced her with Cindy Birdsong. And did you know that Diana Ross showed up at her funeral? She's broke in that coffin and showed up at that funeral in a mink stocking."
Oh.
And walked in that funeral. I just thought of Diana Ross walking into Florence Ballard's funeral and a tear fell.
I mean, it is a tragedy.
I've told that story now. When we did a show together in Atlanta, I thought, "Oh, I got to tell a few Leslie George stories." So I told that story, and Emerson said, "You know, there's going to be a lot of young queens in that audience who don't know that." And so Emerson came up, and then I said, "Okay, for you young gays, the Supremes would be like Destiny's Child. Beyonce would be
Diana Ross.
And Mary Wilson would be Kelly Rowlands. And then Michelle would be Florence Ballard because we know she's going to die broke."
Oh my God. That's hysterical.
Tell us what you're going to do with this film now, because it's not going into general release.
No, really, you know, the original concept, we said, let's just shoot this play and we'll put out a DVD, and that way it can get out to the people who really need to see it. It was really a result of the fact that last year we played 25 film festivals from July to November, which was far more than we'd ever hoped for. And we won 9 audience awards, 15 awards total. And this great film booking company that specializes in LGBT films getting booked in art house theaters approached us and said, we love it. We'd love to help you get it booked places. And so they have. And this is the 9th of 15 cities that we're playing at least an art house theater for a week, which is far beyond what we sort of ever hoped or expected. So we're taking advantage of that opportunity to continue to make people aware that it exists. And then we will put out the DVD and the Blu-ray and get it to, you know, online and streaming opportunities, really, so that the kids who need to see it can access it. The kids that, you know, can watch Netflix when their parents aren't home and they don't have to know that it happened. And so that's really what's important to us. And we are also working with LGBT-affirming churches and lots of LGBT youth and fundraising groups who want to do single screenings.
So it's not going to play at First Baptist Church downtown?
I mean, but they have not responded.
Special rate?
Apparently that they are not interested. I mean, I always thought the Baptists loved a good deal like anybody else, but...
Well, they're in the title.
I would think.
Yes, and I think that after that title came out, they were going, why didn't we trademark that?
Right.
You know, my mother, I said this the other day, in one of the shows I talked about, I wrote this play. My dad was a Southern Baptist preacher, and my mother was the high school drama teacher who was very supportive of me, but sort of appalled at some of the things that I wrote and wrote about, especially our family. And so when I wrote Southern Baptist Sissies, and she called me one day and she said, what are you doing? What are you working on? And I said, oh, I'm working on this new play. Oh, because, you know, she's a theater person. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you're writing another play. What is it? And
oh, no.
It sounds exactly like Leslie Jordan. It seems like and I just the invitation. And I said, well, I'm writing a play called Southern Baptist Sissies. She said, what? I said, Southern Baptist Sissies. And she was kind of, oh, Delford, please change that title. Do it today. We're not the only ones who don't like the gays. Change it to non-denominational sissies.
Non-denominational sissies.
It doesn't quite have that ring. That might be that alliteration
roll off the tongue. Although maybe if that was the title, we could get Prestonwood to show it up at their, you know, worship compound in the football stadium or whatever it is where they hold service.
And it would certainly... have the right audience there.
Absolutely.
Well, I think it could go with Pentecostal Sissies. That might play.
Well,
you know.
And I mean, in
snake handling sissies.
that's sort of the same thing.
I know, but that would
make. Yeah, but in that, I mean, you know, we say Southern Baptist, but honestly, the response I get from, I mean, Catholics, anybody. Pentecostals, Assembly of God, anybody who was raised with religion responds to this piece. And quite frankly, sometimes people who just felt different, who were treated differently, they respond to
it. Oh, you don't have to be gay. There are all kinds of reasons that people are made to feel the way those four characters are in this play.
Well, and that's sort of what we found in traveling across the country, you know, because we won the audience award at Chicago. Well, there's obviously, I mean, they're predominantly Catholic and definitely not a very strong Baptist presence. And that's the universal message that other people relate to, is that everyone has felt rejected for some aspect of who they are, and whether it's religion or school or church or, you know, we've all had that experience. And the idea that he creates so beautifully at the end of the film, of that a world where love is the overriding theme, is something we should all aspire to. And so that aspect of it is, I think, what has made it resonate far beyond the LGBT community.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I think is really striking is just in the last year or so, there have been so many really brutal murders of LGBT people in East Texas and South Texas. And it's just really like on the rise. And I think it goes back to what you were saying, is that the other side's desperate and losing. So they inflame their language and they get very, very desperate.
Plus we have a black president.
Well, that's true.
I mean, they're so upset by so many things.
Yeah.
Oh, their hearts, as my grandmother would say. Yeah.
Yes. Bless their hearts.
It's that whole mix of things, though.
Yes.
But I think that this message is really very, very resonant, because I remember with absolute terror when I was about 4, realizing I was different. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know anything about sexuality or anything like that. I just knew that I was different in a bad way. And it wasn't until much later, like I would look at like Donna, you know, Dr. and Mrs. Reed, Oliver Stone or whatever the show was, Donna Reed, where our theme music comes from, and just think, that's not going to happen in my life. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be that husband, wife, 2.2 kids, you know, frilly dress, fixed dinner. That wasn't going to happen in my life. You know, and so I think there's a lot of kids out there, even in our community here in Texas, that this play and this film is going to really resonate with in a big, big way, because they don't have a way in a lot of towns to reach out.
And that's why we want, we really want to get it on as many Netflix, wherever we can. We want to make sure that they see it. Because, you mentioned that I worked on Queer as Folk. Three seasons, not two.
It was three seasons. Oh, okay.
But when I was on that show, since, I can't tell you how many gay men who said, that's how I first connected to being gay, because I would sneak Showtime in my home and I could watch and I could connect, you know, in the hinterlands of America. Because when I was growing up in Zapata, Texas, you know, there was nothing. There was, you know, the town beautician. That was it. And that my dad kept saying, stay away from him. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. That's what I was.
You could catch it.
Not that I would catch it. I mean, it was that whole thing that really upsets me, where they equate being gay with pedophilia. Mm. That's exactly what going on when my dad said, don't get close. You know, that's what he was saying.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink, and we're talking to Del Shores and Emerson Collins from the new film Southern Baptist Sissies, and we'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
Our Dead Radio present a live performance by David Gans Friday, May 2nd at Poor David's Pub. David Gans has spent years documenting, archiving, writing about, and sharing the world of the Grateful Dead, and is an accomplished musician and performer in his own right. Come be a member of the audience on the air at this premier benefit event. Kalachandis in Dallas will be providing a free vegetarian dinner included with admission. Come join us Friday night, May 2nd at Poor David's Pub. Poor David's Pub is located at 1313 South Lamar in Dallas. Doors open at 7. Tickets available at KNON.org, Bill's Records, and Groovy Goods in Arlington. That's a live broadcast, fantastic food from Kalachandis, and a live performance for his first ever show in the state of Texas, a man who has done so much for deadheads everywhere, our very own David Gans. This is a KNON Lone Star Dead benefit event.
The Community Food Bank opened 28 years ago as a soup kitchen. Today it provides food to over 400 families a day and supplies other soup kitchens in the Tarrant County area. The Community Food Bank is founded on the principle that all those seeking help will be treated with dignity. Free food is provided to those in need. Applicants need not live in Tarrant County. In the real world, needy people do have pets. The food bank is co-located with an affiliated organization, the Don't Forget to Feed Me Pet Food Pantry, so that clients in need are able to feed their four-legged loved ones and keep them as part of the family. Open Monday through Thursday for registration and services at 3000 Galvez Avenue, Fort Worth. The phone number is 817-924-3333.
I'm Michael from UNT, and I listen to Lambda Weekly on KNON 89.3 FM.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink. Laurent took today off so that he could go Easter egg hunting with Gabrielle. He has a 5-year-old.
It's a perfect time to be 5 at Easter. I mean, that's the really good age to be.
Oh, I thought because today is 4:20.
Well, yeah, I guess
you know that
too,
little drug connection.
I know, but I worry about some of those potheads trying to smoke that fake grass and all the Easter baskets.
Ooh.
I mean, it seems like a dangerous day to be a fan of the illegal substance.
Might be. What do you have coming up?
I'm going to go see my cousin Jerry after the... No. less detail.
Zoom out.
We're talking more general.
I have the rights. Our next project with our company is I Have the Rights to Sordid Lives Again, which I'm going to... you know, I'm going to do what the fans have asked for. I'm going to give them one or two more movies and then call it a day. Gather the cast one more time. And we're hoping to raise the capital to shoot here in Dallas. We want to shoot here.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, we want to shoot both of them here and we'll shoot them at the same time. So I'm almost finished with the first screenplay. And that's called A Very Sordid Wedding. And it really does. I brought the characters into 2014. So what you get to see what has kind of happened and how they've evolved and, you know, how GW and Nolita are no longer married.
And how one of them just completely looks different now.
Who would that?
One person who, well, that's from the TV show, I'm thinking.
I replaced
him. Well, here's the deal, and who knows who's going to come back. People always keep saying, well, is Bonnie coming back or is Olivia coming back? They will all be off. I mean, I will offer the roles to all the people who are in the series, not the movie. My theory is once you turn down the role and somebody else inherits that role, that David Steen now gets to be GW, even though I'm very close to Beau Bridges still. Mm-hmm. And so Caroline Ray will be Nolita mm-hmm. in the new movies. And but the characters will be there. I don't know, honestly, who will play them all.
Okay.
So you're doing two?
I know.
You're doing a sequel?
That's who I meant. I was trying to be polite.
Yes. That's the one we were getting to.
Yeah, that...
I'm bringing Kurt Geiger back to the film because it works actually for two reasons. It works because I will not be working with the actor from the series ever again. And also, Kirk has, age-wise, it will, you know, 2014, mm-hmm. he will be right for the role.
So when,
I love him. I adore him. He was wonderful in the film, and he's a good person.
Oh, good. That'll be a much better experience.
It wasn't a bad experience when it was happening.
Right, right.
A bad experience
but time has passed.
Yeah.
So this is a sequel. Are you doing a prequel at all?
I did the prequel. And the series was a prequel. So
okay,
so,
well, that's
so,
duh.
Yeah. So I did the prequel, and I don't... I mean, if I were to do... I mean, who knows? I'd never say never, because, you know, Dallas has the next generation, so who knows what I will do later on. I do feel like that... This is the last round for these actors because, yeah, they're okay with me saying, I go, I've got to get them back together before someone else dies. You know?
I mean, it is a risk. You know, there is a time frame for this. Well, they are brilliant people with long and storied careers.
Well, but Rue was one of your characters.
Rue was there. And I mean, originally when we were going to do movie versions, and when Rue was alive, I had planned to use her and... Mm-hmm. create sort of a dream or whatever, you know, to allow her to come back, that character. But when Rue died, Peggy died. She mm-hmm. truly did. I don't ever plan to resurrect that character mm-hmm. just because I adored Rue so mm-hmm. much. And I'm scared of her beyond death. You know? Nobody's going to have my role.
It's like retiring their number on a sports team.
She was amazing. I love her, and we loved her.
Okay, now, Sordid Lives was before your association with Dell.
Yes.
What's your affiliation with the movies?
Well, so
you're staying.
It will be my job to make the movies happen.
You're going to
be a role for him. He's got a role in one of them. He's not in both of them, but he's got a really good role in one of them. And every scene he's in is with Leslie Jordan. So he's going to have a fun time.
It's that's sweet.
Off, you know, for the producing work, it helps. You know,
well, it doesn't hurt that he's a brilliant actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the one thing that I bought.
I'd never say this to him, but he really was brilliant in the film.
Stunning.
Yeah,
I mean, it's stunning work, and he is. Here's the deal. I mean, Emerson, and he's sitting right here, so I can't really say anything negative about him. And I really...
Oh, sure you can.
He would, too.
I don't know why. I really don't. He is truly one of those rare people who has equal sides of the left brain and the right brain. He is brilliant on both levels of producing. I produce all of my, but it is much more of an effort. I mean, there's something that happened to me as I got more creative and more creative. I lost that left brain. Emerson is stunningly brilliant in that way. And I always tell, but I've told him, I said, when we form this production company, I want you to know that I will never forget you as an actor. That is first and foremost. foremost, because mm-hmm. I know that is your intense passion, and you will always be a part of that. So we've got four movies mm-hmm. in development, and he will be in three of them.
And what I was going to say, it was as if that role was written for you, Emerson, in the way that Peanut was written for Leslie. I mean, and it might not have been, but he's made it him.
It was the craziest thing that we're sitting there one day talking about who we're going to cast as Mark, because we just assumed, I mean, or I assumed that I was going to cast him as Benny mm-hmm. because he had done that role. And as he's speaking in the way that Emerson speaks, mm-hmm. I thought, oh my God, you are Mark. Mm-hmm. And I said right there, I said, you should play Mark mm-hmm. and we should replace, you know, and we both came up with the very same day, we both came up with the idea of casting Willem Belli mm-hmm. in the Benny role. So yes, he is absolutely, and here's the thing, I've had many, many Marks, and they're wonderful Marks. The creator of this role, Robert Louis Stevenson, I love and adore him, worked with him many times. What Emerson had that no other Mark has ever had is, he's just kind of mean sometimes. He's got this snarky kind of sarcastic quality that I share. I think that's why we get along, and we have to watch ourselves not to use it on each other.
Yes.
Well, they say sarcasm is the sign of a healthy brain.
Is that right?
Oh my gosh, my brain is so healthy.
You know, a very dear friend who shall remain nameless, Beth Grant, said to me one time that sarcasm, she said that sarcasm actually, if you look at the word, it means cutting like a knife mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she said, so you're stabbing people every time. And I go, my God, I've like committed murder so many times.
You know, I think of it as
I wouldn't have a career.
You know, if it's cutting like a knife, it means that you're sharp.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's how I take it.
Razor wit.
Uh-huh. I did a silly interview the other day for my Bravo show for the People's Couch, and they were asking us all sorts of silly questions because the show is fun and ridiculous. And she said, you know, people often wonder if you and the two guys, Scott and Blake, that sit on the couch with me, if you're scripted, because it just seems to be too good to be true. And I said, actually being serious for a moment, you know, for lots of the LGBT community, that incisive, sharp sense of humor was the only way that we could defend ourselves growing up. I mean, I was 5'10", 120 pounds, soaking wet with glasses and braces from 6th to 10th grade, mm-hmm. and I couldn't beat you up in a fight, but I learned to either disarm you with humor or I could make you cry and run away. And, you know, then we grow into well-rounded, hopefully undamaged adults eventually, and then we have this sense of humor that it's one of my favorite things about our community, is the ability to banter and enjoy that wit about each other.
Okay, there's so nothing better than a catty queen, I must say.
Right.
You never find one in this studio. Tell us a little bit, what's The People's Couch?
Okay, for the uninclined, The People's Couch, it's a reality show that Bravo has. There are eight groups of people. We all sit on our couches and we watch hours of television, and all they do is they set up cameras and they film our reactions to the ridiculous reality shows that exist across all of TV, and then they edit it together into essentially a half-hour clip show of people's reactions to what's crazy on television. And the concept sounds insane, or like the end of civilization as we know it, that it's a reality show about we are watching reality shows. But the response has been really amazing. People sort of tend to be doing that car wreck watching, like, I watched this thinking it would be awful, and I can't believe I'm laughing so hard, because, excuse me, there is a universal reaction we all sort of have to modern reality television. Mm-hmm. It either makes us feel good about ourselves because that person in television is awful, or it makes us feel smart because they're so obviously stupid. And we do all tend to say a lot of the same things watching our TV, and it's sort of aggregating that universal TV watching experience. And the biggest reaction we get is, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I said.
And what I like about it is that at least Bravo does not take all of those shows so seriously.
Yeah,
that's just good to know.
It's not all there either. I mean, you know, I tell you what it does for me, watching reality shows like Dancing with the Stars, it gives me hope that maybe, you know, I'm not the worst dancer in the world when I watch Winona Judd clomp around like a hog on ice.
Well, Aaron and I always watch shows we're waiting for them to say, I'm not here to make friends.
Yes.
That's always a big one. It's like, is the third episode or the first episode or the fifth and one? I'm not here to make friends.
No, I'm not here to make friends.
Well,
good.
As one of the queens immortally said on RuPaul's Drag Race once, it is not RuPaul's best friend race. which sort of seems to be the theme of reality television.
Okay, so just before the show, Del, you were telling us a story about Leslie and you. You were here at one of the bars when you were doing one of the productions of Southern Baptist Sissies. And remember, this is live radio. Should I put my finger on the dump button?
I can
edit
myself. Yeah, it was just basically, we got really, Leslie has been sober now for 17 years, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah, that's what he said, yeah.
I always remember when Leslie got sober because when I turned 40, I was having this birthday party. My friend Benny was throwing me, and he could only seat 12 people at his table. And so I had to eliminate. I was going, okay, who's it? And Leslie was, of course, on the list, and then he went to jail. So I had to replace him. And ironically, the person I replaced him with is now in jail. So that's another story.
Ooh.
But anyway, so that's how I always remember he got so good. So on my birthday, I got a call and said, you have a collect call from the L.A. County from Leslie. Press 1 to accept. Press 1. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. I am calling from jail. Guess who's my cellmate? Robert Downey Jr. So anyway, this was before the sobriety, and we were at the Rose Room Village Station, and it was 2 in the morning, and we discovered that our designated driver was drinking. And so Leslie, and then we couldn't find our car. So we're wandering around the streets and couldn't find our car, and Leslie sees these, I spot these straight boys in a pickup truck drinking beer, and I said, let me ask him where the Office Depot is, because that's where our car was. And Leslie said, no, I'll ask him. I'm a celebrity. And so he yelled out, hey, boys, do you want a beep, a sissy? And I'm thinking, oh, my God, he's so dead. And they looked and they go, oh, my God, it's that little boy. That's that little guy from Ski Patrol. And so he was right. The celebrity got us to our car. And then that was I always think I could write that whole night as a short film. Mm-hmm. No pun intended, with Leslie being the star. Because it ended with us getting back to the Worthington. And the next morning I called him and I said, are you okay? He goes, oh, Dale, you cannot believe what I did. Drunk, I took every flower arrangement from the lobby. And they're in my room right now. I woke up, I thought I was dead. You have to come over here and help me get rid of these things before the maid comes. So I go over to his room and I'm like guarding the stairwell and running with these. And I'm not talking little bitty flowers. He took the big ones.
How many trips up the elevator was this?
No idea. He could not even remember doing it. But he somehow got in his mind he needed flowers. All of them.
Now, you know, you do Leslie just a little bit too perfectly.
I've had some practice.
Yeah, that's very frightening because it's enough that there's one of him out there.
Yeah, well, where was it? There was one when we were, I think when we were looping the series, there was a line and he wasn't available to reloop.
Oh, so you
just one or two words and I totally.
He did it.
He still to this day
doesn't know.
Doesn't has no idea.
Oh, that's
that
funny.
There are two words in the series that are my voice and not his.
That's very funny.
I was going to ask you really quickly. I know we have just a couple of minutes. You know, being Baylor alums as we are, and you know, we have this kind of like little clique, I guess, of gay and lesbian alums from Baylor. I mean, we're small, but I bet there's more of them. More out there than we've identified. Exactly. And in the news this week is the story about Brittany Griner, and her book is out. And, you know, she's just been dropped.
She's not real
like a
complimentary.
Hot potato by Baylor. Yeah. I mean, Baylor has never associated with her since she came out. And she kind of read the Mariah Act about it. And do you feel that way about Baylor now? What are your feelings about looking back at Baylor and how they are today? I mean, we can dance now. But
well, here's the deal. I dare say that without sounding egotistical, I would think that I'm at least one of their most successful playwrights, and I've never been invited back. I've never been honored. When they send out the Baylor, there was one time they actually featured celebrities, the Baylor line, and they asked us for all our credits. And they eliminated Queer as Folk, they eliminated Sordid Lives, and Southern Baptist Sissies.
Oh, wow. You were censored.
Angel and Darman Greg. You know, I was censored. So,
they didn't put Queer as Folk either?
No, none of them.
Huh.
They totally eliminated
I can't imagine that with Baylor.
When we played the Majestic, we advertised in the Waco Tribune Herald, and they, because Baylor is a trademark, they had to ask permission if I could use Del Shore's Baylor alum. They wouldn't allow it. So we did the ad anyway, and it said, by Del Shore's alum of the Big Baptist University.
So you had to restate it, right? Translate it.
But that's how I get even with them. And, you know, and not that there's any getting even. It's just that, you know, what do you do? I mean,
it's Baylor.
Yeah, there's a line in Southern Baptist Sissies. How do you embrace something that doesn't embrace you? So I no longer give to them.
I do let the calls come in because I like to tell them why I'm not giving to them.
Well, and I think my experience is a little different because I actually had a great time at Baylor. You know, their theater department is wonderful, and I have a great relationship with their department chair and their students. And I think what we're seeing is the generational shift that's happening across America is also happening at Baylor, because I think Brittany did great things for the actual student body's perception. And of course, the administration and the regents, they're all 107. Like, their official policy isn't going to change, but I think Brittany changed the world for student life on campus. And I know LGBT youth, as they come out, they get in touch with a lot of us that have been there recently. And the experience of the students on campus, it's sort of like with the dancing. You know, the student body is moving forward much faster than the administration. So that I see hope in, and feel like kids that do end up there for whatever, pleasing their parents or religious reasons, their experience will be better than what the administration is achieving. And I think all of that is at least progress. Well, there's other Southern Baptist sissies out there.
Dell and Emerson, thanks for being here. We need to go.
Thank you.
Okay, come back again.
To Erica, who's listening. She just text messaged me, and she does a lot of work for me on Facebook, and so many people that support us. We love Dallas, and we thank you guys who love us and keep us employed.
Well, come back again.
We will.
This is exciting.
It's truly our pleasure. Thank you.